This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
What do you think and who do you think should have access to camping at our national parks? Like, do you think commercial businesses should be able to compete for spots against you? Because that could be the case under a proposal being put forward in New South Wales, but a lot of campers are not happy. So what do you think? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, this camping debate.
I think it'll change the vibe a little bit of campsites. If you're out there with your mates or your family, things like that, it'll kind of create this bit of an interesting divide.
Yeah, I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this plan. We're going to explain it later. And if you're not in New South Wales, you're not affected by this directly, I am keen to hear how the camping rules are where you're at. Like, are they working or are you finding that you're constantly being disappointed? You can't book a spot. It's too expensive. Having to pay too much. Message in 0439 757 555. Very keen to hear from the camping community, especially if you're doing a lot of it. Also coming up, Senator David Pocock. We're going to talk transparency, integrity, climate, a bunch of other things. He's joining me in studio. First, though.
Hack.
The strongest hurricane Jamaica has seen since records started is about to smash the nation.
On Triple J.
Yeah, right now the world's most powerful storm of the year is hitting the Caribbean. And there's a lot of concern about what we might wake up to in the news tomorrow morning. Hurricane Melissa expected to bring life-threatening conditions when it hits Jamaica in coming hours. Forecasters think it could be the strongest hurricane to ever hit Jamaica. And it's already being blamed for multiple deaths there, as well as in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic. A US Air Force crew has been trying to collect data. They've actually flown through the eye of the storm. So how bad could this be? And how do you even prepare for something this big? Well, Ariana Lucente has been looking into it.
We've been having rain all of October, so the ground is already very saturated.
The island nation Jamaica sits right in the middle of the Caribbean Sea. It also sits right in the path of Hurricane Melissa, which is being called the strongest storm of the year.
I have seen and heard that it's going to be very catastrophic.
Across Jamaica, locals are prepping before the storm hits by boarding up buildings.
We use plywoods to barricade the areas and sandbags to ensure that during the storm we don't have any issues of any debris going inside.
And stocking shelters.
We are expecting that persons will come to the shelter, so we are ready.
And there's a feeling that it'll be something they've never seen before.
The look of how things is going right now and how I see the sky and the weather coming in, I think this one is different. This one gonna impact us hard.
Me personally, I've never witnessed a hurricane that has damaged Jamaica. So I'm not sure if I'm scared because I don't know what to expect.
What we have facing us is a major Category 5 hurricane that is over the waters of the Caribbean Sea and moving closer and closer to the mainland of Jamaica.
Hurricane Melissa is classed as a Category 5 storm, the max strength, with wind speeds of up to 280 kilometers per hour. Evan Thompson is from Jamaica's Meteorological Service.
We see the heavy rainfall producing significant flooding, and this will be over most of the island.
You have been warned.
The storm is expected to make landfall in Jamaica on Tuesday local time, then Cuba later in the day, before heading towards the Bahamas. Some Jamaicans are ignoring evacuation orders.
We're riding out the storm. We're not going to go anywhere.
But deaths related to the storm are already being reported across Jamaica, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. Andrew Holness is Jamaica's Prime Minister.
I have been on my knees in prayer. I know that there are Jamaicans here praying for us, Jamaicans overseas praying for us, but it would appear that the entire world is praying for Jamaica.
So how bad could this get? Well, forecasters are expecting catastrophic flooding, landslides and damage, and that it could become a humanitarian crisis, Bob Larson is a senior meteorologist at AccuWeather.
Particularly dangerous storm because not only is it very intense, but also so very slow moving. How slowly? Only at about 5 kilometers per hour, essentially a walking pace. So not only devastating conditions, but for a prolonged period of time.
Some rainfall estimates are saying Jamaica could see up to 100 centimeters of rain. Karen Madden, a reporter with the Jamaica Gleaner, says this adds to weeks of rain.
We've been having rain for the last 2 weeks or so, almost every day, so the ground is already saturated. So there's a lot of concern as we prepare for what is expected to be a monster hurricane.
In nearby Haiti, it has already started to flood, and some displaced locals fear it'll get worse.
If a hurricane hits, we're screwed. If the hurricane comes on top of all the problems we already have, we'll simply die.
While in Cuba, the government has deployed the military to carry out recovery, rescue, and cleanup operations. And locals are already evacuating. Beatrice is in Santiago de Cuba.
My house is in very bad condition. It is very dangerous for Santiago de Cuba. We must preserve life. We must preserve it above all else.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there, and yeah, we'll stay across this. We'll be keeping a close eye on it over the next few hours, and we'll make sure we keep you up to date.
Hack. You know, we have a crisis of confidence in government. It's at an all-time low. People's faith in the integrity of the decisions we make in this place has been shaken.
On Triple J.
Do you think Australians deserve to know who has access to our politicians in Parliament House? Because there are people out there representing all kinds of different charities, organisations, business groups, industry, all with their own interests, hoping to maybe influence laws and decisions made by politicians. And some of them are given what's called a sponsored pass to Parliament that lets them wander around unescorted and have access to Australia's lawmakers and journalists even. But who are politicians giving these passes to? It's a question that has been asked for a few years now, and Independent Senator David Pocock has been really demanding answers from authorities. He's launched an online register this week, and he's urging politicians to declare who they're giving the passes to. He says Australians should have access to this information. So far, this registry is voluntary, so will it work? Well, let's ask Senator David Pocock, because he is with us now. Senator, thank you very much for joining us. Good to have you back on Hack.
Hi, Dave. Great to be here.
Do we know how many of these passes are out there with people accessing Parliament House and getting around the corridors, roaming free pretty much?
It varies between 1,500 and 2,000. I think it peaked at the end of the last Parliament at 2,000. Obviously, people don't get re-elected and that those passes get cancelled, but at least 1,500. So a huge number of people with access all areas passes.
What does the pass allow a person to do in Parliament? Because some people might be thinking, oh, I don't care if other people have access to Parliament, but what can they do inside?
Well, it basically allows them to swipe through security and go anywhere, really. Sit at the cafes, knock on, you know, members and senators' doors, hang out in public areas. I was really shocked when I became a senator that I could give out basically an unlimited number of these sponsored passes, and I never had to disclose anywhere who they were, and that really just didn't sit right with me. So, you know, I've had it up on my website for the last 4 years, and after pushing the government for the last 4 years to actually have some transparency around this system, they're not going to act. So I figured, well, try and do something about it with a pass register.
Can you give us an idea of the type of people who might have these passes? Because you've created this register and obviously you've put your details onto the register. So who are you sponsoring?
A bunch of community organisations, people who I'm very happy to say have a legitimate reason to come into Parliament House for events, to talk about different issues. Now, with our current system of lobbying laws in Australia, these 1,500 to 2,000 people are everyone from grassroots community organisations all the way to people who work in government relations for Woodside, Santos, Qantas. They're actually not considered lobbyists in Australia. Totally nuts. The definition of a lobbyist in this country is so narrow that if you work in government relations, you're not considered a lobbyist. And so they come in on these sponsored passes. And, you know, when Qantas was doing their thing a couple of years ago and we had a Senate inquiry into it, I asked Qantas, well, who sponsors your passes? And it turns out that the minister responsible for making decisions on Qantas sponsors their passes. And I think everyone should know who parliamentarians are sponsoring access to.
Do some of these people, lobbyists, or maybe not officially lobbyists, do they try and get hold of you when they're in the building? Because I've heard like reports that some politicians actually have to lock their doors to stop people coming in to try to talk with them.
Yeah, during the last term of Parliament, when things really heated up around key piece of legislation, we certainly locked our doors at time. I think part of the nuance in this debate is that I think lobbyists play an important part in our democracy. You want to be hearing from people who have either first-hand experience or are supporting a certain view. You obviously know when they come to you that they are pushing a certain agenda, but you want to hear those views. The thing that I have a real problem with is just the lack of transparency about who has these passes, who gave them to them. And I think that is sort of this base level transparency. You know, that is a very low bar. As parliamentarians, we should just be stepping over that bar and saying, you elected me, this electorate or state and territory elected me here. These are the people that I'm giving access to. And currently, it's only independents who've been willing to do that. You know, the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, the National Party, and the Greens refuse to actually disclose who they're giving passes to.
I want to ask how this register is working. You've set it up. It's now gone live. So it's on a volunteer basis. Politicians have to be willing to fess up to who they're sponsoring.
Yeah, it's totally voluntary until we actually change the rules around this, which I've been pushing for. This is voluntary. What I've said to my parliamentary colleagues, and I've emailed them a few times about this, either put it on your own website and sort of self-disclose or send us the details. We'll put it on a central website, passregister.com.au, where people can actually search and see who's disclosed, who hasn't, who has access. Again, like, this transparency is so important if we're going to actually rebuild trust in politicians and our political system, because you know, we see it at a sort of a record low, and you look around the world, this is a time for politicians to actually raise the standard and start to rebuild that trust. I think this is pretty urgent.
Yeah, we've got a lot of messages coming through on this one. Cat on Ngunnawal Country says, if there's nothing to hide, that pass register should fill up no problem. Which is fair enough. I'm sure a lot of people are thinking that. Justin says lobbyists should be banned or charged with treason. I don't know, Justin, that's pretty dramatic. And as you heard from the senator just before, you know, lobbyists make up a whole bunch of people representing a whole different groups, important for the function of democracy. But people aren't happy about not knowing exactly who has access to politicians, which I think is the problem. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese, speaking with Independent Senator David Pocock about transparency in Parliament. Senator, another thing is integrity that you've mentioned and you constantly talk about, because we know Labor came to power promising more integrity in politics. But there was this report card from the Independent Senator for Public Integrity that's found Labor is not doing well at all. Like, it's failing on 6 of 7 fields, doing just as bad as the Morrison government is, I think, how it's been described. And these areas where it's failing regard secrecy, jobs for mates, reining in lobbyists, parliamentary accountability, an independent public service and oversight of the executive branch of government. I'm wondering, were you surprised by this result?
I was actually surprised how grim it was. You know, we were promised so much by Prime Minister Albanese when they were in opposition, and the Labor Party said, we're going to end secrecy. You know, this Morrison government culture of secrecy will end. And now we actually know that they're more secretive than the Morrison government. You know, they criticised the Morrison government for making board appointments, to giving mates board appointments and all sorts of things. They've continued to do that. So, you know, I think it does come back to this need to rebuild trust in politics. And you can see why people don't trust politicians, because you say one thing in opposition, you get in the hot seat and you go, well, this is actually pretty sweet. We might just continue this gravy train rather than doing what is best for our democracy and for all Australians. So incredibly disappointing, and I think really worrying. And I'm hopeful that the government actually sees these reports and starts to change what they're doing. But all indications are that they're not. You know, that they've got a bill in front of the parliament to make huge changes to our freedom of information laws, which would take us backwards.
Climate policy, which is another big thing being debated in Parliament this week, the government wanting to overhaul environment laws, but it needs the support of either the Greens or the Coalition, each of those sides wanting very different things. Do you think the government's going to get there and get these laws passed?
I'm not sure at this stage. There hasn't been much engagement with independents, which, you know, I think is disappointing. You want the whole Parliament to be able to engage in these debates. The government doesn't have the numbers in the Senate, and Australians elected a Senate that requires negotiation. And I think it's on the government to actually sit down and negotiate with the Senate crossbench, or, as seems to be their preference, with the Coalition. You know, I don't think we're going to get nature laws that protect nature if they go down the path with the Coalition. That is very clear. And when it comes to climate considerations and other things, you know, this is a coalition that is actually debating the science of climate change and whether or not to have a net zero policy. So I think that would be disastrous. There's been so much focus on the politics that I think we've actually lost sight of why we need new environmental laws. We are the world leaders in mammal extinction. Things are not looking good, and this is an urgent task that we actually have laws that protect nature.
How do you feel in this term of Parliament, Senator? Like, how's it all going? Are you feeling like you're getting your views across to the government, or do you feel like you have lost a bit of influence as an independent in terms of influencing government policy?
I mean, certainly in terms of raw numbers, things have changed where the government only needs the Greens or the Coalition, and they don't need other independents in the Senate. But as we saw in the first, you know, few weeks of the new Parliament, the independents pushing for the release of more aged care, home care packages, and with no sort of leverage in terms of numbers, but public support behind us, we managed to get the government to agree to that. So I think there is, you know, huge power in bringing forward common sense, evidence-based policy that Australians hear and go, of course, that makes sense. There should be more transparency. Of course, we should be considering things like a duty of care to young people on climate change. And, you know, I'm going to continue to do that and really push this government at every turn.
And just finally, I mean, the Coalition is also weighing up this week whether it's going to water down its 2050 net zero commitment. I'm wondering, as a politician who spends a lot of time pushing on climate policy, what do you make of this whole debate?
I think this is really tragic politicking and just shows such a lack of leadership and I think moral courage when it comes to the biggest problem that we have faced as a species. No one is saying that Australia on its own can solve the climate crisis, but what we can actually do is have climate targets that are in line with what scientists say is necessary, and then to get on the world stage at every single opportunity and say to the big emitters and to our allies, hey, you've got to do more, because there is so much at stake here. And we're just not seeing that leadership at the moment, which I think is pretty tragic. And I really think young people and future generations will judge us very harshly if we don't get this right.
All right, Senator David Pocock, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Cheers.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through from you. Someone says, I actually met with David Pocock in 2023 as a group of environmental conservation organisations on one of these passes that he was talking about. We saw a lot of great impacts and we were really grateful to use it. So yeah, as you can hear, people are using them for all kinds of reasons. And David Pocock has his list of people on the register already. A lot of passes that he has given out to people representing different groups. Another person says, a lobbyist register already does exist. Anyone can look it up. I think, yeah, one of the concerns of a lot of the independents, though, is what constitutes a lobbyist, what the definition of a lobbyist is, and that it is quite narrow in Australia. So, look, it's definitely something that Senator Pocock, is going to continue talking about. So I'm sure we're going to keep hearing about it on Hack 2.
Hack! People just want to be able to go out into the bush and enjoy it, and it just seems to be getting harder and harder to do that and more expensive to do that.
On Triple J.
How much should it cost to camp in a national park? Because for lots of people, being in the bush is a really big part of Australian culture. Maybe a lot of your childhood memories were made at campsites. And if you are big into camping, it's something you do a lot. Do you stay in national parks or do you stay in caravan parks? Do you do free camping? How do you find it generally? The costs, the demand, supply, are there enough spots for you? Because we're talking about this because there's a proposal in New South Wales that's been getting people riled up. The New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service
is calling for expressions of interest for tourism operators to be able to reserve camping spots and supply services like tent hire, food drop-off. And people are worried about how that might change camping, how it might make it more competitive, harder to get a spot. Some are calling it the commercialisation of national parks, but businesses say it really could keep them afloat and encourage more people to visit the Aussie bush. Hack reporter Alice Angeloni has been looking into this in regional New South Wales.
Hopefully I can make a cool little cooking station and, yeah, let that simmer away while we set up camp and stuff.
This is Matsy. He's on social media sharing his remote hiking, camping and bushcraft. He's originally from Sydney, but back in 2019, he had just finished serving in the military in Darwin.
I was excited to do this road trip, right, and do all this camping on the way down.
He wanted to camp on his way home from the NT to New South Wales, but it didn't play out as he expected.
I just found it almost impossible to book camp spots because you never had reception in most of the places that I was. And then you would rock up and someone would be in the spot anyway. And then it's like, well, there's no staff here. So now it's on me to negotiate with this person that's in the campground.
Okay, so what's going on here?
They put a bad taste in people's mouths well before they've come out with these new plans.
The New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service has been looking for businesses to provide what they call supported camping services in 23 campsites across 16 national parks. An expression of interest, which closes today, suggested businesses might offer tents, equipment, caravan hire or food drop-offs. They say it's about making camping more accessible, but a key sticking point was that businesses would be able to book sites 6 months before everybody else.
Should businesses be able to reserve sections of campgrounds and offer things like glamping?
It's been copping a lot of heat.
Is this a national park or a caravan park? It's seeming to be a lot harder to tell the difference.
People on social media are up in arms, and the Greens aren't happy either.
We are not resourcing our park system in the way we should be.
New South Wales Greens MP Sue Higginson reckons the government wants to privatise public assets to patch up a hole in the budget.
People need to understand that we spend, I think it's less than 1.8% of the entire New South Wales state budget goes to environment.
Framing it as increasing accessibility to people who may not have the equipment or the experience in camping is one thing.
Olivia is from Newcastle. She's in her 20s and spends a lot of time on outdoor missions. She reckons these changes will make it harder for people to go bush.
I think it will have the opposite effect because these campsites are already in such high demand and it is already so hard to secure a campsite.
This isn't the first time the New South Wales government has proposed changes to camping arrangements in national parks. Earlier this year, there was a proposal to hike camping fees in national parks, some by as much as 600%. New South Wales National Parks said it was about addressing issues with ghost camping, where people book a site but don't show up. No decision has been made on that one, but Matsy reckons it's the wrong approach.
It's kind of just saying, if you've got money, just like everything else in the world, you'll be sweet.
I'm not concerned about this sort of privatisation idea. What I am interested in is getting more people into national parks and enjoying camping within that, and I think this allows that.
New South Wales Environment Minister Penny Sharp spoke to the ABC this morning, pushing back on the idea that this is about making money.
I asked National Parks this morning, how much are we going to make out of this? They reckon about $30,000 a year. This is not a massive revenue-raising activity. It's about making sure that we've got a variety of things that people can come and enjoy our parks in.
She said they've spent more than $40 million on new camps, sites and upgrades over the past 2 years, and she clarified operators won't be able to book more than half a campsite.
There are some booking systems that happen at the moment that people book a year out in advance, particularly school groups. It's about managing these campsites. Some are very popular.
And in a statement to me, a National Parks and Wildlife Service spokesperson said these private operators won't be able to book sites in school holidays and no operator will have exclusive access to campgrounds.
Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there and hearing from you on this one. Someone says if you're paying to camp, you're not truly camping. Another person says, I am on the road full time and only do free camping. Don't do national parks. It's too expensive. Look, I want to get into this a little more now with Cam Reid, who's a tourism operator on the New South Wales South Coast. So he knows a bit about this area, what's going on. Cam, thanks so much for joining us on Hack.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
What do you think of this plan to open up national parks in New South Wales to commercial operators? It's not everyone's a fan. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, listen, I mean, I suppose I look at it from two different angles as a commercial operator. I mean, we could definitely benefit from this. You know, some of the figures I've seen from New South Wales National Parks research indicate that, you know, 10% of people in New South Wales have never camped but are keen to try. So, you know, there is a bit of a market there. But I think the main lens I'm kind of looking at this through is as a punter. I love going camping with my friends. I love getting out there, whether it's bushwalking or just weekends away with friends and family. Yeah, I don't like where National Parks is going with this. I think it's a slippery slope, and I think it's sort of part of a bigger picture of privatisation that's happening within our national parks. And yeah, I'm not a fan of it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, given that you, as you say, are an operator yourself. What exactly is worrying you?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things, but I think National Parks campsites are already overbooked. You know, whether they're ghost bookings or not, you know, we can talk about that. But I think, you know, this proposal is taking up existing sites that, and it's already going to put more pressure on those booked out national parks. And I also think that, you know, what National Parks are trying to do here, I don't think that's their job to facilitate this. I think there's plenty of private enterprise operating on private land, plenty of ways they can do that. I don't think we need to be necessarily yet putting extra pressure on our National Parks campsites. And I think, you know, the other thing is, I think it'll change the vibe a little bit of campsites. If you're out there with your mates or your family, things like that, it'll kind of create this bit of an interesting divide, I think, with people around the campsite.
Have you already noticed changes in the camping experience? Like, how are things at the moment?
Yeah, I certainly do notice that the campsites are often booked out at certainly the places that we operate on the south coast, on the far south coast, but often we'll turn up and no one will be there. So I think the ghost booking problem is definitely a thing. But yeah, otherwise, I think, you know, especially, you know, everyone knows we're in a bit of a cost of living crisis. So I do think that camping is kind of that thing that a lot of people, whether they're young people or families, can hold on to as a way of getting outdoors. And I mean, you know, we know that getting outdoors is fantastic for mental health and just a great way to unwind. So I think putting any extra pressure on people's access to that is going to be problematic.
I mean, the New South Wales Environment Minister, Penny Sharp, is saying that all of these proposals, potential changes, are about making camping more accessible. Like, if there are, you know, businesses that can provide equipment, food, it might encourage more people who might not be into camping to get involved. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, the way I see it is that if there are all these extra people who want to go camping, that's fantastic. And I think, you know, opening that up to people is a wonderful thing. I'm just questioning whether it needs to happen in national parks that are already, you know, quite busy. I suppose some, you know, solutions there could be to expand those campgrounds that are already under extra pressure, to, you know, build extra infrastructure to allow something like this, or really, you know, leave it up to the private sector to do it. You know, there's plenty of hip camps out there where you can go camping, you know, and have a taste of camping and have everything provided for you. And that's happening on private land, and that doesn't impact public land, where, you know, I suppose my view is that the national park should be for everyone, and that's what we're sort of focusing on.
Cam Reid, tourism operator on the New South Wales South Coast, thank you very much for joining us on Hark.
Too easy. Thanks, Dave.
And it's not just Cam. There's so many people on the text line right now who've got big thoughts on this. A lot of campers chatting to us this afternoon. Beck says, no way. Spots are already so hard to secure. Another person, people are basically bringing mini cities into national parks, so I understand the intention in regulating this. Let's go to Jared, who's on the phone line now. Jared, you are a bit of a camper. What do you make of this proposal?
Yeah, I think honestly it's just a bit shit. Any kind of barrier to entry to going camping in, you know, our own national parks is not good. As soon as you put a commercial layer on it, you just get, you know, the wrong kind of people. Yes, people want to try going camping, but, you know, it's just extra space. As, you know, previous caller mentioned, there's already a lot of bookings. The spaces are limited, and putting a commercial barrier to that is just not kind of what the whole hiking and camping vibe is what about.
Yeah, which it sounds, Jared, like that's the biggest concern for a lot of people who do camp. They don't want, it to change. What they love most about it, they want to retain. Look, thank you so much for having a chat with us. I really appreciate you calling up and giving your thoughts. So many other people who are also messaging. Someone says, in Victoria, when some camping spots were made free, people booked multiple spots to not have neighbours. It also resulted in a lot of no-shows. Yeah, those ghost bookings definitely been a massive problem across the country. Another person, as a regular New South Wales National Parks camper, I think this is total BS. This has blindsided people who want fairness for families and casual camping. Yeah, heaps of messages coming through, but that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.